This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy. This is iFanboy Media Explode, episode 15. Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. iFanboy Media Explode, episode 15. My name is Connor Kilpatrick. I'm here with Josh Flanagan.
Hi.
And Ron Richards.
Hello, my friends.
And this is Media Explode, our show unlocked by the patrons at patreon.com/iFanboy. It's where we talk about non-comic book media because we have all of our other shows to talk about comics and related media. This is our fun time. This is our
Listen, the Jamokes need a break. Yeah. Okay.
God, and do
listen,
they.
I might not be there weekly with you guys, but I can use a break too. So
I miss the days of the show when I could like start reading a magazine while you guys were talking about some book I didn't care about. But that doesn't happen anymore.
Sorry.
Just know, because every once in a while he'll be like, right? And I'll have to go, yeah.
It's my fault.
Thanks to the patrons for unlocking the show. And there'll be spoilers, I guess, possibly in some of the things we talk about. But we'd like to always start the show. We're not in lockdown anymore, so I figure we can't call it quarantine streaming anymore. But we can call it like what we've been enjoying for the last month.
Listen, the world might not be in lockdown, but I feel like I'm still in lockdown.
He has twin toddlers.
Yeah, for the exactly, next 18 yeah. years. I guess I can start. What have I been enjoying since we last spoke a month ago or so ago? We're at the tail end of our Schitt's Creek binge. We're about a quarter of the way through season 6, the final season. Really enjoying that. Watched In the Heights, which I liked but didn't love.
We watched that last night, which I liked but did not love.
Right.
And it's funny because I don't want to whatever, but because we were talking about it, because as some, like, we're all fans of Hamilton.
Yep.
Right. And Carrie and I were talking about it after we watched, because we were just counting the number of times we're like, well, that was used in Hamilton. Like the style of song, yeah, the and the tropes and some of the things like that. And also the theme of the stories, where like who tells your story and all stuff like that. But we were laughing because I was like, just in shock at how much of like because we said like, oh, God, this is like a Hamilton knockoff. But he did this before Hamilton. Yeah. So then we turned it around and we're like, man, if you're a big Lin-Manuel Miranda fan and you were like loved In the Heights and then you went to go see Hamilton, be like, what the hell? He's just ripping off In the Heights.
Well, arguably, he said that he did it better.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I read some articles because I was trying to see about people talking about the similarities and like Connor, the lottery song and in the $96,000. Yes. Like that style is, I forget what song, but it's, I think it's Running Out of Time or whatever that is, Out of Time. But there are a lot of like direct similarities to Hamilton. I read some critics who said that like actually In the Heights is a superior musical than Hamilton.
I couldn't remember a single song or melody from In the Heights. I mean, I liked In the Heights. Yeah. I thought the performances were good, and the story was fun, but I guess the musical, I didn't come out humming anything. I still play the Hamilton soundtrack a lot, or I couldn't tell you one song.
Hamilton was a moment in time and the history aspect and all that sort of stuff, but it is interesting how they are very similar both in song and structure and theme.
Yeah, it's not unusual for artists to explore a theme throughout their work.
I do have a question to posit to you, Connor and Josh. If you are producing a show about Latinos in the Bronx or New York City, is it a SAG rule that you have to cast Jimmy Smits?
It should be.
He's not wonderful. Just New York City, my friend.
I feel like he's in everything. Whenever I'm like, oh, he's so good.
He was very good in the Heights.
Yeah.
Also watched The Friends Reunion, which I liked a lot.
That was weird. As someone who worked in television production, and Connor, curious if you agree, I felt the structure and some of the decisions they made with that was very odd.
There were things I definitely would have done differently if I was directing the show, but I wasn't. I would have spent more time with them alone on the set than I did in the talk show format, because I thought that led to more interesting stuff, and that's the kind of stuff the fans really wanted to see, was them sort of reminiscing on the set with each other. But then again, if you hadn't done the talk show format, you wouldn't have found out about Schwimmer and Aniston liking each other. You do what you can.
Everybody hated James Corden.
He's polarizing.
Yeah.
That was fun. The one I wanted to really focus on, which is going to be a short discussion because you guys have nothing to say about it, was I don't watch a lot of reality television, but I love the Below Deck franchise, and this season's Below Deck of Below Deck Sailing Out, which just wrapped up, was the best season.
What is Below Deck? Is that the Star Trek thing?
No, that's another deck show. This is a reality TV show about super yacht workers who work on super yachts in the Mediterranean or around Europe. You know, it's basically Downton Abbey on a boat.
What channel is this on?
Sun Bravo.
I've never heard of this.
Sun Bravo. It's fine. You don't have cable.
I don't. Josh, have you heard of
it? It's been going on for about 10 years. It's one of the biggest shows on Bravo. I've
been involved with this since In the Heights started.
Are you reading a magazine?
Yeah, I am.
Perfect. It's like a little nostalgia trip for you today. But, you know, it's a show that focuses on the crew who crew these luxury yachts that people, really rich people, rent out. And it's each two episodes constitutes one group of customers. And then they switch, to the next charter, You know, it's all young, attractive people working on a luxury yacht full of booze and food. And it's not trashy reality TV, but it's a really enjoyable look at the difference in class on a boat like this, where the people are striving to make their lives better below deck. And then people above deck are the rich people renting the boats out, and they're often really horrible. It's just really fun. I look forward to it every Monday. And this was a great season. They had emergencies. They had accidents. The boat crashed into a wall. They ran out of power in the middle of the ocean.
One of those ocean walls.
Yeah, when they had to dock. They had to dock the boat. And they crashed into the dock because they lost power as they were sailing towards the wall. It was usually the drama from the show comes from the crew being somewhat incompetent, but everybody in this one was really good at their jobs. The drama came from all the interpersonal stuff. It just was a lot of fun, and it's one of Bravo's biggest hits next to their Housewives franchises, and I just love the hell out of the show.
Yeah.
It's been going on for about 10 years.
Interesting. That's a long time.
To not know about something.
There's Below Deck, this Below Deck Mediterranean, about the Mediterranean boats, and then there's Below Deck Sailing Yacht, which they've added recently, which is not about a super yacht, but about a giant sailboat that serves the same purpose you can rent out with your rich friends and be, you know, it's like a 5-star hotel on the sea. It's
interesting.
Fun. Mm-hmm. It's probably on Peacock because that's where all the Bravo shows are. So if you're interested in that, that's where it is.
Yeah, I the reality TV thing, it's funny because my wife was watching something that was reality and I was like, oh, aren't you so glad you know me and I purge reality TV from you? And she's like, oh, I'm sorry.
Did she throw a book at you?
How many seasons of The Real World and Big Brother did you watch? And I'm like, yeah, that's fair. But I have moved on from reality TV.
I don't watch hardly anything. I think it's like Survivor and Below Deck is basically it for me at this point.
Yeah, I pretty much only watch Top Chef at this point. But I mean, part of it is now like you just know the formula of how they, like, at the beginning, it's all about, okay, they just said this in the cold open, and that means so and so is going to get kicked off or whatever. And that's almost part of it at a certain point. But I don't know if I found anything that's, I don't trust anything to be at all real anymore.
Oh, you want to know a weird thing that happened, and you guys won't know who this is, but a few seasons ago on regular Below Deck, they had an accident where one of the crew members got knocked off the boat and his leg was tangled up in a cable, and the other end of the cable was attached to a cleat on the boat. And if it hadn't been detached, his leg would have been ripped off and he would have died in the ocean. The cameraman on the show dropped his camera, you know, which Josh will tell you is like a cardinal sin of the crew getting involved in the reality TV, dropped his camera and untied the cleat really quickly, and he was saved. The cameraman was the brother of my freshman year roommate in college. But you guys didn't know that my freshman year roommate in college. Oh, we were friends at that point. But I was like, that guy's name is familiar. And then I Googled it and it turned out he was my freshman year roommate's brother.
Huh.
Wow. It was interesting. Yeah.
Looks like there's a new season of Top Chef that started that I didn't know about, which is how I watch Top Chef every year or so, I say. I wonder if there's new Top Chef. And then there is.
My freshman year roommate, who was not with us in the communication school, was some other school. He was only there for 1 year. Also became a professional cameraman.
So it just happened that he didn't go to the communication school, but he ended up in that.
Yeah, my roommate, I think he's like a Survivor Amazing Race camera guy. He's in that production group. And then his brother is in like the Bravo world.
Huh.
Yeah.
I wonder what their holidays are like.
I don't know, but like, probably never there, honestly. But anyway, that was interesting. Move on. Josh, what did you watch or enjoy the last month?
I was trying to decide of the two things I wanted to talk about. The first one is I finished whatever I was watching, and I couldn't figure out what to put on next because it has to be just the right thing during the day when I'm trying to work so I keep it going and I don't have to think about it very much and I have to find something new. And I was like, I think I'll watch Justified. Mm-hmm. So I started watching Justified again, which I hadn't seen since it first came through, which I always remember liking a lot, but thinking it was a little spotty and I didn't really like all of it. And I thought the first season wasn't great, then the second one was. And it turns out I was wrong about a lot of that stuff and that it was pretty good all the way through.
I love season one.
Yeah, no, it was literally much better than I remembered it. I think I just hadn't had it down.
It has more of the gunslinger ethos than you know, the seasons beyond that get into like deeper, longer stories. So the first season is more of like a Western, almost like an old 50s Western where he comes into town and defeats somebody.
That was the thing I didn't like as much about it because I thought it was just like episode of the week. But really, there was an overall storyline that I hadn't remembered. So I've really been digging that. I'm almost through the end of 5, which is the Michael Rapaport season, which is funny because season 5 is the one with the most recognizable guest stars. It's not the best one at all. So I'll wrap it up and see how it's going. But it's been really fun. I thought, man, there's so many great characters and so many great actors in this. It's all these, you know, alumni from Band of Brothers because Graham Yost is the executive producer and showrunner, and Oliphant and Walton Goggins are just like, how did they not win a ton of awards? It's just a great show.
What I like about Oliphant is he sort of has adopted the persona of...
Yeah.
Like, he wears a cowboy hat now, and he sort of talks like a laconic cowboy, where before he was kind of like a surfer guy.
Yeah.
It's like he sort of became...
He found his niche. He found his spot.
He's really good at that.
Yeah. Really, really great.
And it's funny because, you know, he had been in Deadwood, which is sort of where I first knew him from, and he did that, but he, like, Justified, which is arguably... not as good of a show and probably less influential overall. Like that really became his thing as opposed to the Deadwood character. So they're actually very different martial gunslinger guys, oddly enough. I guess then the other thing was, you'll remember, savvy listeners, that last month we were talking about how I was listening to the Death on the Wing podcast about basketball and deaths. And then I said I'd watched some 30 for 30 documentaries on basketball, and it turns out I'm watching sports again.
I've been getting these text messages from Josh now on Fridays and Saturdays going, are you watching this game? And I was like, what the fuck is happening?
I've watched every game of the NBA playoffs from the end of sort of round two into the semis.
Oh, my God. Did they pull you back in?
Kinda.
This is like 1997 when I had been out of baseball for 8 years, and I happened to overhear on the radio that the Mets got Mike Piazza, and it pulled me back in. I was out, and now you're in, Josh. Now you're back in. You like sports again.
I doubt that I would follow it like moment to moment in the season.
However, hardly anybody does, by the way. Just so FYI. Hardly anybody follows the NBA regular season. They all come in for the playoffs.
So.
Diehards do, but most people aren't diehard NBA fans.
So it was that podcast got me started. So I started thinking about it, and then I was like, I got ESPN Plus for free. I don't pay for it, so I started watching some of those again, and I've watched pretty much all of the NBA documentaries at this point. And then I started playing NBA 2K21 on my Xbox because it was there. And then I was like, I wonder what's going on in the games. Oh, look, it's playoff time. And yeah, I've been texting back and forth with Connor as games are going on. I'm missing a game right now.
Connor, do you like basketball?
I watch the playoffs.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And the thing is that every single game, we're down to, if you listen to this, I don't, you'll listen to it later in the week, so it might have changed, but we're down to the four teams. We've got the Bucks and Hawks, and then the Clippers and Suns. And the first stuff that I had watched was the last round was the Hawks and the Sixers. And I was like, this just looks like a bunch of people playing one-on-one. Because I was aware that the game had changed significantly since the last time I watched it. We went from this, you know, sort of hard-nosed defense, big man game to whatever this, that everybody shoots from everywhere all the time game. And I was
it's become a video game.
I was kind of fascinated, but kind of annoyed by it. You know, as it sort of, but then when we went into the later rounds, some of the other, like I thought the Suns and the Bucks played a little more team ball. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I've decided these are the ones I will root for, you know, and I'm starting to like get to know people again. It's really funny because all of the players who I know are all the old commentators now, which made me go, oh, so all the people we're talking before were the old people then. But it's enough that I was like, is that Reggie Miller talking? And, you know, oh, it is. I knew that at least.
But and Jeff Van Gundy was the coach of the Knicks when you were watching before.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. I was aware of that as well. Because you can watch there's a documentary on Reggie Miller where they talk to Jeff Van Gundy because of their rivalry against the Knicks.
I'll just say I enjoy that I text Ron about baseball and I text you about basketball, and I think it's fun.
Which, by the way, Connor, are you not watching Euro Cup?
Yes, I am. Well, as much as I can. They're on odd times.
Text an Italian about that.
Yeah, yeah. It's
like a real
the,
one.
I got to tell you, the Italy-Austria game this weekend nearly gave me a heart attack.
Well, Italy is, you know, they're a powerhouse this time, but... I happened to be randomly watching a game where the guy collapsed and died on the field and then was resuscitated. But
that's pretty bad.
I'm watching it. It's just on Epstar Times. But yes, I have been.
Do you have favorites in the NBA right now that you're?
I don't really. I mean, you know,
I kind of didn't care who was going, but eventually I sort of was like, well, I think this team's better. And I realize when I say stuff like that, I feel like I'm the one who takes the old person one. Because whenever you watch anything about basketball in the past, there's always the people like, they didn't like these new kids coming along at Michigan. And I was like, oh, no, I think that's me now.
So, I mean, I grew up in New York, so I rooted for the Knicks. But then slowly, you know, in the 90s for sure, the Patrick Ewing years. But slowly, my family's off in San Antonio. So we sort of morphed into becoming Spurs fans, especially during the Tim Duncan era. And the Spurs are not good anymore. The Knicks made it to the playoffs but lost in the first round. So I was rooting for the Nets because I lived in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
They got eliminated. The Clippers are an LA team, but I don't really have any affiliation for them other than I know people here who like them. But I'm just kind of watching the games and enjoying them. I sort of pick a team. Like, I'm rooting for the Bucks. I think the Bucks are fun. I don't really care who comes out of the West. I'd be fine with the Clippers, but, you know. So I guess ultimately I'm rooting for the Bucks, I guess, overall.
Yeah, I could go with that. And the thing is, this, I don't know who are actually good teams. Like, I don't know if I'm just picking out the favorite.
Mm-hmm. Or the Nets were the favorite. Then two of their three best players got hurt in the playoffs.
See, I know all their players, but I also, like, I knew that they were big, but I didn't realize that they were all really old, relatively speaking. So, like, they were all the best players in the NBA 5 years ago, and they're all on one team now.
Ron. And I put
them together.
Save us and the audience. I mean, I'm enjoying it, but
So what I've been watching, we actually watch a lot. I was going to mention we watched In the Heights, and been watching a lot of Finding Nemo and Little Mermaid and the various Frozens. But aside from the kids, actually, there are two things. On the Hangout, Josh, you and I talked about, for our patrons who listen to our most recent Hangout, I think on this show, too, I've been complaining about documentaries that don't really give you the answer. You know,
wait a minute. I think. Hold on. I haven't watched it yet. I just haven't had time. I was planning on watching The Hangout that I missed because I was sick. Did you really say the Golden State Killer had never been found?
I didn't finish it. I said I was on the last episode.
Yeah, but that was like a huge news story last year.
I totally missed it. I had no idea.
The first person found with genealogy from one of those
services. Yeah, I completely missed it. I was treating it like completely as if I hadn't known anything.
Ron, I could have warned you that whole documentary about him is stupid because it's based on a book written by Patton Oswalt's wife who died tragically. Wow. But his name does not appear in her book. She had no idea.
Yeah,
she
did not crack the case. I know. Well, you should watch the show.
I don't want to.
Because they handled it really well, and it was really interesting. So for those, as Connor jumps all over me and jumps the gun, I'd finally caught up and finished I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which came out last year, and it was on HBO, which is based on Michelle McNamara's book of the same title. She's Patton Oswalt's late wife, who was working on a book about the Golden State Killer. What the show does is kind of give its – and this is a brief mention. I have a longer mention about something else. But basically it tells her story about investigating the murder while also telling the stories of the murders. And really, really fascinating. fascinating. And they just released a follow-up episode a year later after the guy who got caught got sentenced and the reaction and stuff like that. So it's a great, it's a nice complete story, really interesting. And it was a nice true crime thing where I found out the answer. I found out who it was, which is fascinating.
Well, the thing is, like, it's the hottest genre, right? True crime.
Yeah.
So yeah. All these companies are rushing out these documentaries, which don't have rap. I agree with you. It's annoying. Like, every once in a while, it's okay to have a documentary about an unsolved case, but it seems like they're just taking on anything now that they can possibly turn into a three-part documentary if there's no resolution whatsoever, and it is annoying.
Yep. Yeah, it's frustrating. So this was nice to see one that actually had a resolution, had an interesting angle to it. Tragic at the same time. I mean, it was a gut punch when she passes away and Patton Oswalt and his kid and all that stuff and their kid. Really tragic, but really, really interesting and fascinating case. And I'm glad they caught the guy and figured it out. And yes, Connor, she did not have his name, but they went through and they played clips of her positing, like, well, I think it's a guy who's like this, and it was, and like she basically described this dude. So like she was zeroing in. Had she not passed away from like taking,
yeah, she wasn't done with the book. Had to finish the book,
not him, but another true crime writer and her researcher finished the book, and Patton helped Patton make it happen. But tragic that she died of, like,
yeah,
she was taking Adderall in the morning and then taking Xanax at night, and like it was bad. But anyway,
spoken about it in detail. It's really sad.
Yeah, it's really brutal. Really, really brutal. But so that was good. So I'll be Gone in the Dark on HBO. But the other documentary that me and my wife watched, we were just randomly, in fact, we're going to be talking about Mythic Quest this episode on the media split. And we were watching, so we're on Apple TV, and it served up a documentary called 1971, the year that music changed everything.
I've watched two of these.
And oh, well, you might want to stop listening. We're like, oh, that looks interesting. And so we watched the first episode and was really drawn in. Being a huge music fan, I'd never realized the impact that 1971 had. Exile on Main Street from the Rolling Stones, Hunky Dory from David Bowie, Who's Next from The Who, What's Going On from Marvin Gaye, Blue by Joni Mitchell, Led Zeppelin 4, right? Elton John's first record. Like all this stuff happened in 1971 in regards to music. And the positioning of this documentary was that with all the stuff coming out of the 60s and with all the stuff that had changed in the world was changing and music was at the forefront of it. And it really impacted so much that was going on. And like, first episode, like, yes, there's a lot about the Beatles breaking up and John Lennon and George Harrison, the Bangladesh concert, and like, Josh, the stuff that is right up your alley.
Yeah, no, yeah.
And then like episode 4 or 5, it just kind of crashes into a wall.
I had felt that at the end of 2, which is why I didn't get keep going.
Sometimes you got a 90-minute documentary in. You don't have a 5-part series.
I mean, I think that was what it was.
It was like 8 episodes.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I saw that and I was like, that's way too much.
So it's 8 episodes. And what's fascinating is that it starts off really talking about, like, this is what's going on in the world and this is how music is directly affecting it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, Marvin Gaye putting out a political record and, you know, and people taking notice, or like John Lennon, you know, and doing all the stuff, you know, the protests and all that sort of stuff that he would do, right? And really, really did it. And then it just sort of deviated to like, and this was going on, and this was a song that came out. Like, it just, like, it got really meandering, and it wasn't.
And every once in a while, you'd be like, oh, I like that album,
right?
Anyway, then there was this,
right? There was like a maybe a 2-minute throwaway anecdote about Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground. I'm like, do an episode on that. I was like, that's like, I want to know more about that. But there was a bunch of just, they got really meandering about some topics, and they kept on, they were very obsessed with the Rolling Stones because this is the Rolling Stones post Altamont and banished from the UK because of tax problems. And so living in France and getting addicted to heroin and all this sort of stuff. And as you both know, I detest the Rolling Stones. So one episode was enough, but like 2 or 3 was like, oh God, come on.
Didn't Mick Jagger executive produce it or something?
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. That would explain it once again, why there's so much in it. No, he didn't. No, he had nothing to do with it. Executive producers, Asif Kapadia, who's the director, James Gay Rees, Adam Barker, and Chris King. So it started off as something that was like, this is really exciting and this is really cool. And then it just kind of, you know, kept on, you know, like I said, meandering and going off topic and not, you know, an entire episode about Carole King. But
important songwriter.
Yeah. Huge. But true. So like we stuck it out. We watched the entire thing. We made it through all 8 episodes. Wow. It was just, I felt like, I was like, this is a really cool concept. And like, I'm excited to watch like not a true crime documentary and like, and see like a aspect of the world that I didn't quite understand at that moment. And so I know more about that year, but overall it was disappointing.
It was too much. Really, like, I watched two of them. By the second one, I was kind of struggling. I hadn't decided to quit, but I saw there were so many. I was like, there's not going to be a line that you can hold through there. Like, I was thinking, you know, things that work like that are what the OJ Made in America documentary. Like, that's the only one I can think of where it was all so connected for that long. Maybe
the Michael Jordan one.
But again, those are both easy for us to hold on to because, I mean, what Ken Burns, you can do it. That's right. About it. It's tough. And I don't think that there was enough of a hook to hang this on, and which is what you're saying. But I didn't feel it from early on. There was some amazing footage I had never seen, though.
And I would, if you can skip ahead, I think to episode 7 or maybe even 8, Josh, because you'll like the I thought the Who would be more featured, but it's limited to just one episode, and it was specifically about Pete Townsend's exploration of electronic music and how that
Lighthouse project.
Yes, and how that led to Bob O'Reilly, and that was very interesting, and I was like, okay, cool, and so it was for a documentary that was about how the year music changed everything. I was surprised at how many episodes weren't really about music, which I feel like that, you know, there's your
time to fill.
Yeah. But check it out.
I feel like there are better years. It just so happened that this was 50 years ago.
Well, I don't know because it was 50 years ago. I didn't even do the math there, but looking at the run of records and the stuff that happened to it, it was an impactful music year for sure. You know, maybe it did change the world. Maybe it did have an impact, and maybe like music made people pay attention to things where previously they weren't or whatever. But I feel like you could say the same about like 69, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say 68, 69, 70.
Yeah. But either way, if you like music, if you like history, it's interesting. If you want to know the story behind Attica, it's in there.
Attica.
which did lead to a very good thing where my wife was asking how does Al Pacino tie into all this, and so then I had to pause the documentary and look at her and I'm like, have you not seen Dog Day Afternoon? And so then I had to pull that movie up and show the Attica scene and explain that context. Oh, John Cazale.
So our main topic tonight, Mythic Quest season 2. Mythic Quest, well, season 1 is called Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet. I don't know if it's officially still called that or not.
They dropped the sub thing.
Well, it's still listed that way to IMDb, but it doesn't matter. Mythic Quest was a show I first heard about on this very podcast from Josh early on in the run of the show when he said, this is a show I've been watching, you should check it out. Was that the case or was it right after you texted me?
I mean, it was you. I talked to you probably the exact same time that Romo did. He might have actually said it first.
So it wasn't on this show, but you really talked it up on this show. And that's how I got to watch it, was based on you talking about it. So Mythic Quest is highly tuned into this particular podcast. All three of us watched the first season, and I would say loved it. I think that's fair to say that we all loved the first season.
Loved it.
Mm-hmm. Season 2 just ended last week. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 episodes.
Yeah, weird number.
And I almost want to give this season a mulligan because they had to rewrite every episode other than the flashback one because of COVID.
Yeah. Like,
this wasn't what they planned to do for season 2. And once you know that and you watch it, you can see it's all very siloed. All the characters are kind of bubbled off.
I mean, I didn't know that was the reason, but I absolutely noticed. Like, I was like, oh, they're working under limitations.
Yep.
And I'm not going to say I didn't enjoy it. I really did enjoy watching every episode. And I always got a good laugh out of it, but it wasn't nearly as strong as season 1, and it was kind of a bummer.
Yes.
I would have put a pin in the backstory episode and its immediate follow-up, because those are, I think, separate stories. Yeah, let's stay
there. So I will share that feeling, Connor. Forever, we should tip our hat and give credit to Josh. Josh is the one who turned me onto the show. Yep, Josh, I will give you this credit till the end of time.
That's my legacy. Thank you.
That's your legacy. Turn Ron and Connor onto Mythic Quest. But,
which was okay for one season.
And the thing was is that I enjoyed it, and I actually found myself loving David Brittlesby the most this season. I thought the executive
producer. He's great,
producer,
but I thought maybe he was it too much this season?
No, I thought it was great. Every time I was waiting for it. I loved it and all this stuff. But everything, every other, and he went through some dark stuff. The wolf, yeah. He went through some dark stuff as a character, but every character just, really took a turn for the dark or the negative in a way that was almost distasteful at times. Like it just went really dark and really mean at times, with the exception of the testers maybe. And honestly, it wasn't until the finale where the finale felt like the first season again.
Yeah, I thought the finale was strong. Other than backstory and the follow-up to backstory.
Yes.
I thought the finale was really strong.
The finale was really funny. It was funny and like
heartfelt
and the thing that I zeroed in on while we were watching the finale that I pointed out to my wife when we were watching it, I'm like, this season has not been about the game.
No.
And the first season, what made it interesting was these people interacting in the world of the game.
But it came back to the game at every point.
Yes, exactly. It was dealing with the white supremacists or dealing with the paradigm, and everybody was reacting within this, where this was like the game was just the backdrop, which I realized how much of a factor that was meant to be. And the moment the game came back into it in the last episode, and there were glimmers like in the beginning of the season with the art department, I thought that was hysterical.
Yeah.
Like the art department guy made me laugh and all that stuff. And that all went away mid-season, and then it came back at the last episode, and I was like, this is what I love about this show.
Well, because the game is a unifying force amongst all the characters. Yep. I think what's missing in the season is there's no through line to the it felt almost every episode was its own thing that didn't relate to any other episode.
There wasn't a story.
Yeah.
The characters' arcs were not clear at all. Lindsay and I were just like, what the fuck is going on with Poppy this season? Like,
yeah, she was a
jerk. It made no sense. Like, she was just being a jerk, but without ever coming back around again. So by comparison, then you go back to Ian and you can't put a finger on what the fuck he's about either.
Yeah.
And the only thing that, I mean, like the only thing that really came through is that Rob McElhenney and the crew are kind of over millennials.
Yes.
Like that was the best running. Like, why do you think anyone cares about your feelings? You know? And they kept nailing them. And it was like, you're just annoying. You're not wrong, but you're annoying. And it's funny, but there were funny things every episode, but it's almost not enough to hang your hat on.
No, because there wasn't a story.
I didn't think it was okay to be annoyed by the testers, but I was really annoyed by the testers for most of the season.
No, they were annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The short hair one was written to be annoying. She was annoying. She was a parody of the overly woke white person.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They tried to put something in with Brad's brother, but I didn't care at all about that, and it kind of came and went. There wasn't like an overall story to this.
I did like what's her name? The Brad's, David's secretary assistant who became
what's her name?
She's hilarious.
She's very funny.
Like that storyline was ridiculous enough that it didn't need to be that weighty, but every time her and Brad were on screen, I think those are some of the strongest points of the season.
Yeah.
I felt bad for them and for me as a fan because clearly they're scrambling.
Yep.
And it seemed like the solution was we'll find a funny hook for each episode and write around that and we just won't have a full season arc because we can't do it.
Yeah. To counter the Brad stuff, I did enjoy the Brad stuff. And the reason why I actually liked the brother, because they're shimmering, because it was like personal conflict, gave you a little more insight to him. But it was about for a moment, it was about the game. And then it stopped being about the game.
Well, they brought it in and then it went away. And then it came back at the end for the final. Like it just sort of it wasn't like season one with the streamer who was their nemesis for the entire season.
Right. Yep. Yep.
You know, they brought him in halfway through. Out of nowhere, and then all of a sudden he's gone again until the very end.
Yeah, but nobody else really knew about him.
Right.
Like the last episode, it was like, wait, for what? Brad's gone? Like they didn't even know.
Yeah.
Now, partially, backstory and Peter, which backstory is the flashback episode like they had last season, and Peter was the follow-up, which they didn't do last season, directly following up the events of the backstory episode.
Yep.
It almost was like those 2 weeks, as amazing as I thought they both were, killed the momentum of the story.
Yep.
Because last season we had one flashback. It ultimately thematically matched what was happening in the rest of the show. But here it was 3 weeks until you got back to what was happening with the characters.
And what I thought was interesting was that when I realized they were doing a flashback episode, I was like, oh, they're going back to the well. Right. Like they did this really cool thing and now they're going to do it again. I was slightly kind of annoyed. But once I saw what they were doing with it, I was like, all right, I'm in. And it was done so well. But what I think is interesting in comparing the flashback episode in season one had nothing to do with Mythic Quest, but thematically, like you said, like tied into the theme of the show and all that sort of stuff. And while this directly was directly about one of the characters, right? So it was still a little different, and I felt like that's why they needed the follow up.
Yeah.
And of course, you get William Hurt, you use him.
Yeah,
for right. Sure. So having William Hurt as a guest star doesn't hurt. But I still, so for a moment I was like, oh God, don't do it again. But then it was good.
And F. Murray Abraham is incredible. So have him being relegated to a face on a screen, because again, he's 80 years old and they probably couldn't get him on the set for a while.
Right.
Hurt the show. And when he came back in, it was better.
Yep.
The only thing about it was I think that those episodes were good, but I didn't really like them all that much in the way that, like, I was like, wow, they're really, they did the time period really well and the characters. And I thought, you know, Big Head did a great job acting as that character, but I wasn't super into it. And really? Therefore I wasn't as much into it later. You know, I thought they were good, but I don't know. It didn't quite scratch whatever the itch was for me. But I think at the same time, you're absolutely right in that first episode when you had that swerve, or first season when you had that swerve episode, there was a real sense of what the hell is going on here. But pretty quickly, you kind of just forgot that you didn't know what was going on. Whereas this time, it just doesn't have the same effect.
Yep.
And I was like, I don't think you can keep doing it. I don't think it works, or at least not in the exact same spot in the exact same way. I think it's also just because CW, I know we got his backstory, but it didn't really seem to have any impact on what happened in the season.
No, and that's my point. But I thought as a story, as a one-act play, it totally takes character and breaks him apart.
Yes.
Like, it's everything we thought we knew about this character is wrong.
Yeah.
You know, this whole time he's this drunken, you know, womanizing has-been who's holding on to his one crowning glory. And it's not even his glory. And that makes him even sadder. So I
don't even disagree with you. I wasn't really that drawn into it as a character. I thought it was really good, but I don't think I liked it that much.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was great. And then I thought the follow-up, Peter, where he goes to visit his old friend, was really good too. I mean, there was
the tester girl didn't need to be there.
She didn't need to be
there. Did not. Yep.
At all.
Yep.
But I thought, you know, him and William Hurt were great in is two people who once were friends, once respected each other, and now are complete strangers, and there's animosity.
It was really honest, I thought. Yeah. Like, I thought it was really like the nuance of relationship, and like he, you know, how F. Murray Abraham's character, Big Head, held it against him for 40 years that he got the girl and he didn't, right? And like, and that's real. And it's like, it was interesting to see how it manifests in that old age, and then to see them, you know, in facing mortality, and like the scene, you know, the scene with the William Hurt's daughter.
Yep.
Really, you know, kind of brought it back to earth. And like, because the thing was, is that like, you know, the F. Murray Abraham character is a bizarre, you know, all the Thai ladyboy stories and all this sort of stuff, right? And you don't know, like, what planet is this guy from? And the first half of the flashback, you know, you really like him.
Yeah.
You know, he's wide-eyed, he's from Iowa, he's in LA, he loves science fiction. You see this whole thing, and then you watch the kind of crumbling of him through jealousy and competition.
Well, he also doesn't have talent.
Yeah, exactly. And like the realization of not having talent and wanting, you know, being in the same room as Isaac Asimov and all those people, and like seeing it so close, but like, you know, coming to the realization that you don't actually have it and doing whatever it will take to do it. And then the moment that he does what he does in order to win the Nebula Award pretty much sets the tone for everything you know about the character, because like he's never been to Thailand.
Right.
Right, like all that stuff that he says, he's never, you know, like all this stuff.
He's working at a rent fair. He was selling chicken at a rent fair.
It's all BS. Yeah, exactly. And so you kind of it makes him this really kind of sad, tragic figure. And that's why I think it's also really interesting that in the finale, he's the one that realizes that they're done with the game.
Yeah.
You know, and like that he's the one who delivers that, because so the theme was there. There are ties to it where you kind of understand where it's coming from. But yeah, but I think the disjointedness and what they had to do with the season got in the way, unfortunately.
I mean, also, he has his moment of triumph in that backstory episode where he sees Pong, and all of a sudden the future is laid out for him. You know, and people who are visionaries, that happens, where they make the connections in their brain.
He was talented, but it was before his time.
Right. I see where this is going. I see the possibility with this technology. And then he goes and excitedly tells his editor at the magazine, played by the writer of the episode, and they're like, you're a nut job. Get out of here. Talking video games. They're going to tell stories and be interactive. And so that becomes his life eventually, which is nice for him because he had that moment, even if it's all based, if the rest of his life is based on lies and fraud and stories.
It's sort of as if like you came up with this format to do like a video show about something niche. But you showed up far too early.
Far too early.
Before there was a platform that would allow people to be successful with that, doing much worse work than you had originally pioneered.
Yeah, it hits close to home. Anyway, it's tough. You know, it's tough because you take... I thought three of the episodes were really strong, but the rest were... Like, the bottle episode was fun, but it wasn't, you know... There were fun moments of things.
I don't like bottle episodes because I know. And I get it. Like, again, it's not their... You know, they're working with what they had to work with, but you could tell. I remember that was why I stopped watching... It pissed me off about that Preacher show. I was like, so you're just going to be in this town because that's all the money you have? Or like the,
yeah.
I think it was like the second season of The Walking Dead. I was like, oh, I see. You're just here now because that's what the budget allows for, you know, which is, again, it's not their fault, but once you notice it, you notice it.
Well, it's a COVID thing. But I think part of the fun of the first season too was the sprawling cast of characters that were constantly bouncing in and out of scenes. Like, I love the woman in charge of the community. We saw her for one scene.
Yep.
And then she was out. We never saw her again.
And also, the HR woman in the first season was funny. And this, it was just like, oh, I hated every time she was on screen because she was so mean.
And she was also really one-dimensional, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I noticed that in the finale. I was like, oh, she's just getting me annoyed with them again. Which, that seems like, don't put her in there if you don't have anything for her to do.
Right.
I felt bad watching it because the first season was really... And I told everybody to watch it, but it's just, you know, the problem is on the whole TV, and Ronald know what I'm talking about. TV is kind of messed up right now.
Oh, so messed up.
Because of the COVID situation. Like, a lot of shows ended early and then they finished their last seasons as part of the next new season. So all the momentum is disjointed and all the rhythm of a season is disjointed, or like Billions put out six episodes and then this didn't make any more. And they might do the back six next year. Like, it's...
Mm-hmm.
It's all out of their control, and I'm not coming down hard. I'm not like wagging my finger at the makers of Mythic Quest. I feel bad for them. It's just unfortunate because the show was so great, and now it's just like, well, season two was kind of what it was, and hopefully season three, if the Delta variant doesn't take off, is better. But man, it was a bummer a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they haven't greenlit season three.
Right.
So that's the thing. So yeah, the finale ends with Ian and Poppy leaving the game.
Really seemed like the end. It could have been the end of a show.
It could be the end of the show now Brittlespie's running things.
Well, he was before. He just wasn't before.
I know. Yeah, but you know, I have no idea where they take it in the next season at all. I mean, which I think is a compelling way to end it, but also it's like, oh, it doesn't. You know, this could be it.
I mean, the show is called Mythic Quest, not called Ian and Poppy. So, like, if they go off to make another game, what happens then?
Yeah, exactly. True. And it's also... I mean,
it couldn't cost that much to make that show.
Yeah, I mean, it's a full... I mean,
to the other shows that are on Apple TV Plus?
No.
Yeah, possibly. But also, like, I was reading... I don't know if you guys read the latest Entertainment Weekly with Jason Sudeikis on the cover, but it said, and you probably saw it in other things, but, like, Ted Lasso, season three and done. They're done after season three. So, like, maybe... Apple TV might be doing less of a pump out as many seasons as you can and just be like, oh, you're done with the story, let's move on.
Well, that's what they're all doing.
Yeah.
Netflix doesn't really go beyond season three for anything, unless it's huge.
Right. Or reality.
Right. Well, I hope we get another season to sort of right the ship and finish the story.
Yeah.
It'd be very sad if this was the end and they had, you know, it was a season that was hobbled by things outside their control.
Yeah.
Because it's a great cast. It's an incredible cast.
It's just fun.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what that last episode reminded me, like until the very end, but like the banter was fast. And like when the tester came in,
that was a great scene. Poppy,
that was great. It was like, oh, it was like, and I was like, I'm like, why couldn't the season been more of this? You know,
like, you're annoying us, but you're right. Now go be right. I think it's still worth watching, especially if you enjoyed the first season. There's things in every episode that will make you laugh, but man.
Yes.
Bummer.
Yeah.
So we have some extra time here. I've got some emails in the mailbag I've pulled out. Laid them out on the table.
All right. Close your eyes and pick one.
The first email is from Eric S. from Sweden.
Ooh.
Eric says, as a student of your podcast for the last 14 to 15 years, I know that you've talked about reading Star Wars novels. I'm looking to take a stab at reading some myself. So my question is, what are your favorite Star Wars novels?
Oh, man. Good question. So I guess the question is this pre or post canon reset?
Doesn't matter. If it's got Star Wars in the title, it's not.
I feel like there may have been some amazing Star Wars novels in the time from which we stopped reading Star Wars novels.
Right. So it's just our favorites. We're not saying these are the definitive best. Mm-hmm. Yep. You know?
Which is funny because I just think it's very funny how there's like a whole...
There's a whole industry we've missed out on.
There's a line in the sand of which Star Wars refuses to acknowledge the books that we enjoyed.
Well, that's true. Our books are no longer canon.
Yeah, there's Star Wars Legends.
And now there's a whole industry of Grand Moff Tarkin books and Grand Admiral Thrawn books. And
yep.
Just, I know nothing about them. I stopped reading the books in 1999. And I read really one after that.
What's really interesting, which, by the way, was the book in 1999 that you stopped reading, the one where Chewbacca died?
Yes.
Yep, me too. I put the books down and said, nope. I was like, I don't want to live in a world that doesn't have Chewbacca.
Yep.
Well, luckily for you, they pulled that back.
Yeah, luckily. Before we get into it, though, I went to Wikipedia because I'm like, oh, let me pull up the list of books. And the Wikipedia page list of Star Wars books starts in 2014.
What?
Really? Anything before 2014 is not canon and therefore does not exist. We should probably preface any recommendations we make by saying that none of the stuff we like is in canon.
Which is fine. It never was to begin with.
Influencing stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was all fanfic anyway.
Yeah.
Which is fine. All right. So, Josh.
I mean, I'd say that the Timothy Zahn books, the original Thrawn trilogy.
Yes.
You know, that was the first one I read. I think that tends to be the gold standard of Star Wars books as far as I've never heard anybody speak about any of the other following ones with the same sort of reverence. Like, you have to read these. And I think that it tells you how important and good they were, in that, like, Thrawn is a character that they're bringing back. And Mara Jade isn't canon, but she's been around for a long time.
Hey, Zahn wrote a Thrawn book in 2017 called Thrawn.
Right. Right. Because, you know, they recognize the value in that.
Well, he did a whole Thrawn trilogy. Oh, yeah, he did more than that. Four of them.
Those books was that what it really did was...
Wow. He's done six Thrawn books. Sorry, guys. Six Thrawn books since 2014.
First one, just so for who might not know about it, Heir to the Empire, volume one of a three-book cycle by Timothy Zahn, came out in 1991. So you want the Star Wars, the Thrawn trilogy. That's what you want. You want
this, this is the episodes 7, 8, 9 that we, that we didn't think we were going to ever get. Maybe this is a better call.
You know what's kind of crazy? I'm sorry. Wikipedia is supposed to be a nonpartisan list of information.
They're toeing the line.
If you didn't know any different, you would think there was never a fucking Star Wars novel before 2014. I can't even find a link to where you'd find the old books.
No, I know. I moved over to the Wikipedia.
But that's crazy. Like, that's crazy.
Yep. It's crazy. I'm right there with you.
So we're talking about a time period before episode one comes out, and there hadn't been special editions yet. But in the midst of all that stuff sort of bubbling up, when I was in college is when I read the books, and it was just the closest I had to the feeling of, like, I really want to know what's going to happen next. I have no basis. And it's funny because if you read them now, it's going to be like, well, we know what happened to all these people. But back then, we didn't. And this was the best possible.
Oh, it was the most exciting thing ever.
And it was so page turning. And it would do that thing. I mean, this isn't like a not normal thing, but it's the standard of the books where you'll be reading about one thing happening to one group of characters, and you get to the sort of climax of that scene, and they switch to the other characters, and you go, "Duh, I don't care about this." And then the same thing happens again in that chapter, and it does it over and over again. He does this through three books, and it is, oh.
There was a glorious time. So Heir to the Empire came out in 91. I think I stumbled upon it. It must have been at least 92 or 93, because I don't think
I think it was 92 when they hit the popular.
Yeah.
Because I remember going to buy the hardcover for Dark Force Rising and then having to buy the soft cover for Heir to the Empire.
Yeah, well, I remember buying the soft cover, the little small paperback of Heir to the Empire, and just like, what the hell is this in high school? And there was a run from 92 up until, up until 99, where there was multiple trilogies out there at any given time, right? You know, remember the Truce at Bacora, right? Yeah, so basically what they did was they had multiple trilogies running in paperbacks, and then maybe once or twice a year, a single story hardcover would come out. Right. And like Truce of Bacora was one, Darksaber was one, right? And like they were so good. They were just
you had, but you also had great things like the Rogue Squadron books,
Rogue Squadron,
and the Bounty Hunter books, Tales of the Bounty Hunter, and
that's the one that we all love, was that there was a couple of anthology books. Yep. There were two of them. One was Tales of the Bounty Hunters, came out in 1996, and Tales of Jabba's Palace, which I forget when that came out. I'm trying to find it now. Those were just short stories about the background characters, which. By that point, by 1997, we were all about the background characters.
Yeah. But it was the thing because you didn't have real answers. So,
again,
it's going to be weird looking at those because you've been given quote-unquote answers.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, when you read Tales of the Bounty Hunters, like, you didn't know anything about it. But they're the ones, because they're the ones I read, they're the ones I go to. They're my headcanon. You know, they're my,
absolutely.
My thing. That story of Dengar is the Dengar story, although I think that is kind of the only Dengar story still.
No, they haven't fleshed out Lak Sivrak.
Right. Or like Malakili. The Rancor Keeper's story is in Tales of Jabba's Palace, and that's the story as far as Muf-tack. I'm concerned.
But there, but like within the Zahn books, and then as the books continued on, you know, you got introduced to Mara Jade. Yeah. Right, who was like you, kind of like love interest for
kind of. He was Luke's.
She was, yeah, it was, yeah. And then and Han and Leia had kids. They had Jason and Jaina, and then at young, they named the third kid was Anakin, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and then like Luke starts a Jedi Academy, and you meet a whole new class of upcoming Jedi. Like it touched on every aspect that you loved about Star Wars, because you had like the Rogue Squadron books, which is about the X-wing fighters, right? You had the Luke Jedi stuff that was going on. You had, you know, Han doing, you know, the Carillion trilogy. You got what was the name? Oh, Corran Horn.
Yeah.
The Hotshot Carillion.
You pulled that one out of your brain.
I sure did.
There was the Shadows of the Empire book.
Yep.
That took place between Empire and Jedi with Prince Jizor.
Well, because
now
here's the thing: Shadows of the Empire was great because Shadows of the Empire was because at the same time as all these books, you had a burgeoning video game,
right?
Kind of a silo of Star Wars. There was computer games like Dark
Continuity
Forces.
In a way.
Yeah, there was a computer game, Dark Forces, and then there was like X-Wing and Rebel Assault and TIE Fighter, like all these flight sims. There's all these really cool stuff, and then. They brought it all together, and they came out with Shadows of the Empire, which had a video game, a book, action figures. Like, it was the most coordinated across the Star Wars universe anything had been. And it was like, you're reading the book about these characters. You're playing the video game with Dash Rendar. You could get the ship from Toys R Us. It was a great time for Star Wars fans. And then it all came burning down in 97.
What's interesting is that my Star Wars book fandom begins, as we said, 92 with Dark Force Rising, the second of the Thrawn trilogy books, and then I read them both together that summer and then waited patiently for the third book. And then I dropped off when they killed Chewie in 99. And then I just looked it up, and Star Wars Scoundrels, which is the last of the books I've read.
Yeah.
Because it was Timothy Zahn coming back for the first time. And I decided, okay, I'll do this because it was Young Han and Chewie and Lando on a heist adventure. And that was 2013. So right before they shut the door,
wow!
The blast doors came down right on me.
Open the blast doors.
None of these books are canon. I thought maybe Scoundrels had made it, but apparently not. I enjoyed Scoundrels. If you guys hadn't read it, I think you should. It's fun.
What was the book where Chewie died?
I don't want to know. It was stupid.
Was it Rogue Planet? No, it wasn't Rogue Planet.
It was dumb.
Well, that one you're okay with losing from canon.
It was interesting that... It's just interesting. I mean, I get why they did it, but from a business standpoint, but that's a lot of years they just have been erasing from existence.
Well, I mean, yeah.
I'm not saying they need to be in continuity. They obviously can't, and they don't need to be. The only thing that matters is the films, but to disregard them and totally just swap them to the side is crazy.
Vector Prime.
Oh, that's right.
That's it.
Vector Prime.
That was the book. R.A. Salvatore, the writer. Oh,
God.
Yeah. He did a bunch of them at the time.
Ron, yeah, I have a visceral memory of finishing that book.
There was my bed,
senior year, in my rickety old house on Pennsylvania Avenue in Ithaca, New York, and just being like, fuck no.
1999, yep. I didn't even read it. So there was 14
years till I picked up a Star Wars book again.
There was a roster of dudes writing those books. Like, so R.A. Salvatore, Kevin J. Anderson. You could guess what kind of book it was based off who wrote it.
The Kevin J. Anderson books.
Yeah. Roger McBride Allen. He wrote a lot of the Carillion ones, the Carillion trilogy stuff. Oh, God. It was so good.
Have we answered Eric's question.
I mean, we've answered a question. To the best of our ability, which is clearly extremely biased in terms of time and...
Well, sure. Now, that said, post-New Canon, I did buy the book from a certain point of view, which I'd hoped would be like the Tales, whatever, and I brought it on vacation, and I never read it. It's still sitting on my tablet. So.
I read the first Chuck-what's-his-name book before...
Wendig.
Yeah, he did a trilogy, I think, and I read the first one that came out before episode 7. And that was it. It wasn't bad. I just didn't care.
So what was the impetus for doing that? Was it the same thing for me just when I picked up Scoundrels? Like, I just want to read a Star Wars book and then...
I think it was Aftermath.
That's the book.
Aftermath. So I guess that came out right after episode 7. I think that would make sense because I think I was on a high from that. And I thought, well, maybe I can get some more of this. And,
was that the book that Dr. Dre co-wrote?
No.
Okay.
You know, and it spent a lot of time with characters who I didn't know. It was rather like making up new ones instead of ones that I'd gotten to know. Yeah, I mean, it was fine, but I finished the book, but I never read another one.
I'll tell you what Star Wars books that we collectively all loved that you can go read and has nothing to do with the canon, but those Rinsler making of books.
Yeah, that's true.
And there's also a book about all the action figures that Steven Sanderson did. Like all of the, like I'm on, there's a Tashin book, the Star Wars Archives, 1995 to 2005, like these great huge coffee table books. These books are tons of fun. If you can pick one of those up, if you love Star Wars, these, you know, big books with great photography and like all the historical stuff and the behind the scenes stuff, the J.W. Rinsler books, The Making of Star Wars, Empire and Jedi, you cannot go wrong.
So I'll just say from a novel standpoint, the original Timothy Zahn trilogy, which was Heir to the Empire, Dark Force Rising, and what was the third one?
The Last Command.
Look up Michael Stackpole's X-Wing books, Rogue Squadron.
Michael Stackpole, that's the guy who wrote those books.
Rogue Squadron, Wedge's Gamble, and the Kryto's Trap, and also the Back to War. Josh, I think you should reread those, actually.
I think I was in the middle of one of them when I stopped reading them altogether. I think I was like, what am I doing?
There was another really good one that was like the New Jedi.
But they were really good about like dogfights in space. Like it was really written for someone who, like, those were really good. And then Zahn did more. Did Spectre of the Past, Vision of the Future.
I feel like I read those.
Listen.
I feel like because they came back because there was two. There may have been a second Zahn trilogy after the first one. I think I read those.
There had to have been. Well,
you know what you got to read? You got to read. Go back to where it all started. If you've never read Splinter of the Mind's Eye by Alan
will
D.
say.
Foster.
During that time, I tried to read the 1977 one, the one that came out that says it's by George Lucas but isn't, and it was some of the most impenetrable prose I've ever encountered.
That's Splinter of the Mind's Eye.
Really? So
Splinter of the Mind's Eye was the book that came out after Star Wars.
It's
just called Star Wars?
It's called Splinter of the Mind's Eye.
One that was like the Star Wars novelization.
Oh, the novelization. It says
by George Lucas.
Right.
Yeah, probably wasn't.
No.
Well, I mean, if it made no sense, it was.
It was pretty rough.
So, Splinter of the Mind's Eye came out in 1978 and was like the first out-of-movie story told, in it. What about A.C. Crispin? Do you remember him? The Han Solo trilogy?
Yes, that thick book. Oh. Josh, there was not a second trilogy. There was a duology. There was a second.
I read those.
A second Zahn Thrawn duology, Spectre of the Past, Vision of the Future. That was 97, 98.
I misspoke. It was Tales of the Bounty Hunters and Tales of the Mos Eisley Cantina.
Yes.
Not Jabba's Palace. Tales
like,
of the
were
Mos
you
of...
like, do I want to know everything about the Bith Band? You do.
Yes. And yes, I do. Yeah.
It turns out you really do.
Yeah.
So hopefully Eric found some good stuff in there. This is our point of view.
The Chusa Bakura was really good. As a single book, like one book, like that was, I remember that one being really good.
So. Listen, Star Wars has taught us one thing. It's that truth always comes from a specific point of view. And this is our point
from
of view.
From time to time.
Yeah. So, Eric, thanks for writing in. Hopefully you can find some Star Wars books in there. Contact@fanboy.com is what Eric wrote into to get on the show. Thanks for that. We got a bunch of emails. We'll get to them eventually.
Can we do one more? Is there a quickie?
No, we can't do one more. We're out of time.
Honor.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, I don't want to go to bed.
I know. So we'll have more to next time. We'll get to those. There's a good one we got in here that'll lead to lots of arguing, which is always the best.
Great.
Go to patreon.com/ifanboy. Join up if you want to see more content. They unlock this show. They unlock the books blows, the talks blows, the YouTube shows. All that's unlocked by the patrons over at patreon.com/ifanboy. We thank everyone who's become a patron, supports the show, and unlocks shows for everyone to listen to and enjoy. And of course, there is the weekly pick of the week show where Josh and I talk about the week's comics. There is All About Android, Ron's weekly
Weekly, every Tuesday.
Weekly show about phones.
Ron's weekly?
weekly show talking all about Android phones and the Android operating system and hardware and fun stuff. Go check that out.
And we'll be back next month with more Media Explode. And until then, I'm Connor.
I'm Ron.
I'm Josh. May the force be with you.
And also with you.
See what's going on.